Welcome, everyone, to these Goldster podcasts, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles to hear enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their dreams, and, of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration, and today we're talking about healthy living. Please enjoy. To find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello, welcome everyone to our Friday Goldster Inside Story, where we are going to venture into territory where we have not trodden before, the world of investigative journalism, which quite often leads to a book which reveals to us secrets and often not very pleasant ones. We're going to learn, I hope, two things. The first is, what does it take to be a Bob Woodward or Carl Bernstein who exposed all the president's men and brought down Richard Nixon? Or a Michael Lewis who brings the covers off the financial industry with books like Liar's Poker and The Big Short? Now, the young man who you see patiently sitting there next to me might look like a nice, harmless guy, but he wields his pen or computer keyboard like a Charles Dickens of the 19th century. He works for the Times, he has won multiple awards, and he has brought to account dodgy landlords in an expose called Slums of the Future. He has shone a spotlight on the second jobs and conflicts of interest of, guess who, Conservative MPs. He was ahead of the game there. And he's dug into the deep and shameful breakdown of security at Wembley during the Euro 2020 finals last year. Does anyone remember that? People sort of cascading in without tickets and masks and all that sort of thing. And before I get to the second thrust of our inside story, which is about, where is it? Which is about his latest book. I want you to meet the nice guy who you don't want to cross. His name is Billy Kemba, and he's an investigative journalist extraordinaire. Billy, welcome to Goldster Inside Story.
Hi, Humphrey. Great to be here.
Thank you for coming. Now, the second tranche of our conversation is going to be more specific because it's going to be about this book, Sick Money, the truth about the pharmaceutical industry. How do we get our medicines? Why is there a drug for one disease and not another? Why are some of them so expensive or suddenly become so expensive? And I want to talk about that in detail and at length in a moment because I think all our people listening and watching this at the moment will have questions for you about it. But firstly, I want to ground it. Your job, investigative journalism, Tory MPs, football, pharmaceutical, powerful people who don't want you to write about them. How do you go about it?
Well, that's a very good question. It varies depending on the topic, but broadly speaking, we are looking to get hold of documents and speak to people and piece together a picture of what's going on that people in power don't want you to know. So at its core, it's a lot of legwork and a lot of time.
So when you hook onto a topic, say, let's take the pharmaceutical industry, which we're going to be talking about, but you've got a canvas of topics to talk about, and you talk about documents and that. What would your first move be to start unraveling the story?
So often starting on an area, it's because of a specific tip or an interest in a specific part of an industry or a particular business or a politician. But what I like to do first is to really get an understanding of that wider context. So I try and read as much as I can that's already been written, speak to people with expertise and a sort of overview sense of an industry or a business. And then I can begin to drill down into the specifics of what I'm interested in. Because one of the great truisms of investigative journalism is that people are much more likely to speak to you and you're much more likely to have useful conversations if you go in there with some knowledge to begin with, rather than just sort of feeling your way completely in the dark.
Right. And does it have to, is it secret meetings or false identities and that sort of thing?
It can be. It's not always and not often as sort of glamorous as or as Hollywood as that. I mean, the kind of bulk work is often going through large numbers of documents and looking for the one that has the little bit that reveals the new information that you're after, or speaking to a large number of people and hoping to find the one person who knows what, again, what you're after and is prepared to talk about it. So it's a lot of sort of hard graft. I thought the film Spotlight about the Boston Globe's investigation into sexual abuse in the Catholic Church was a very good sort of realistic demonstration of what investigative journalism involves day to day, which is those practices of going through documents and trying to meet people and just the sort of
I mean, a lot of us might remember seeing the film All the President's Men, the character Deep Throat, who was this one person they found that spoke in codes all the time. So you even had to interpret what they were saying. Is it like that?
It does happen. That was turned out to be a very well-placed source. I think it was ultimately revealed to be the deputy director of the FBI. So sometimes there are sources who have to protect their identity, and you have to meet in ways like that protect that confidentiality. These days, it's more often done with encrypted apps and things like that. The technology plays a big role in that in terms of source protection. But no, you do still sometimes meet people in a park by a certain tree, and they hand you a document, and then you go on your way.
That's fascinating. So instead of meeting in an underground car park in a big city, you have an encrypted app like one of these sort of Signal or Snapchat or something like that, and you say, this is how we will communicate.
Exactly. Yes, and you might have a code that says you want to talk to them on a sort of more mainstream communication, and then you'll switch to these apps, perhaps on a phone that's not your normal phone, and those sorts of protections.
And when you go to your editors and say, look, I want to do something on the pharmaceutical industry, or I think this Tory MP needs a bit of... do you have unlimited time, or do they say, well, as long as you can do it by next week, or how does that work?
So it's somewhere in the middle, really. We don't have a strict sort of timetable where it's, I'd like this by 2 weeks' time, and that's sort of all the time you're going to get. But we do take a view... as we go along, is this going to be, how much time do we think this is going to take, and is the sort of end result going to be worth it? And certainly there are projects where you just realise that the kind of scale of the work is not worth it relative to the reward of whatever the particular story is. But no, generally the Times is very good. We're sort of given fairly free rein to pursue sort of interesting subjects, and we're broadly trusted that we're going to come back with something to show for it. Although, sometimes the nature of this work is that you can work on something for a long time and it all falls apart and you've got nothing to show for it. So it doesn't always go to plan.
So when you say a long time, you might spend 3 months on something that just doesn't pan out?
It's possible, yeah. I mean, that would be a particularly unfortunate example. But no, it's certainly, it can be the case. I mean, quite often you're struggling to reach what in the UK is quite a high burden to clear the lawyers and all that sort of side of things, and if you don't get there, you can't write the story.
Goodness, yes, no, of course, because you've got all the legal stuff to get over and everything. Now, before I get on to the pharmaceutical industry, I have, out of my own curiosity, because we're seeing it in the papers every day, when you go out to expose a Tory MP, which you've done, do you find people wanting to talk to you because they're fed up with they're morally... what is the driving force for them to spill the beans?
Yeah, so broadly speaking, I think people generally talk for two reasons. One is because what you're writing is a sort of important, or what you're trying to write is a sort of important public interest story, and they feel strongly that this should be out there, and they disapprove of the behaviour, or they disapprove of what the company's doing, or whatever it is along those lines. And then I think another big reason people talk is because of the feeling that other people are talking to you and they want a chance to give their side of the story, and that's certainly in politics often I think a big motivating factor in what's going on there. I mean, the truth is with some of the Tory scandals we've seen in recent weeks and months is a lot of those were really hiding in plain sight. They're sort of there in registers of interest, and we've seen it with the various coronavirus contracts for PPE and testing and all sorts of other areas, and it's that was a sort of just a kind of cross-referencing of public interest sources, public sources, perhaps with a tip that's got your interest in that area in the first place.
I'm going to go back to All the President's Men again, there's a scene in there where Bernstein and Woodward have got a story, and then they're sitting around the political correspondents and that, and they don't have that story. Do you have this? Do you have a situation where the lobby correspondents, as they're called, and we're doing a book on the lobby with Carol Walker in a couple of weeks' time called Lobby Life, but where those people say, well, you know, Bill is all wrong on this because, you know, if this was happening, we would have published it. Do you get that sort of friction?
I haven't experienced it. Our lobby team are very nice and friendly and very collaborative, but I'm sure it happened. I mean, the lobby, I think that will be a fascinating talk because the lobby is a very interesting and beast, as it were, with all its sort of own rules and traditions and the rest of it. I spent about 6 months in the lobby as maternity cover a few years ago, and that was... it was certainly very eye-opening, very interesting. But no, they're not. They're generally, I mean, it's actually more likely that they would have something useful that they would perhaps give us to help rather than being, you know, trying to push back. But I know that other papers can be different, and there can be tensions between those. Yeah.
And then, of course, it doesn't, if you come out with a bad story, it doesn't blot their copybook. They say, well, that was Billy. You know, we've got nothing to do with what he does. We can't control him.
Well, quite. And so sometimes, certainly, I've been aware of it happening where political journalists might give a tip or the bones of a story to another journalist because you know they want to get it out there, but they don't necessarily want to sort of burn their own contacts because they've got to cover the kind of days in, you know, ins and outs of parliament and politics day to day, and therefore have.
So now we're going to move on to. A topic that I, you know, fascinates me. So if any of you got any questions about the pharmaceutical industry, how the drugs are made, what they're made for, where it is, just put it in and I will feed that to Billy as we go along. But there it is, if we can see it amongst the my fabricated background there. There we go. There we go. Billy's got one too. That's two copies sold at least. And so you decided to do the pharmaceutical industry. We've sort of, and you say it's called sick money, and you say it's broken. Firstly, before I ask you why it's broken, or you can answer it now, what is a pharmaceutical? Is it anything we get across the counter at the chemist? What is it?
So a pharmaceutical is in its simplest terms, either a chemical compound, or we now have biological medicines made from biological material that is used to treat illness and is regulated and requires licenses in the countries in which it is sold. Most pharmaceuticals require prescriptions. Some don't. Those are the ones that are available over the counter. But most require a doctor's prescription to be able to.
So Panadol is a pharmaceutical, is it?
Yes.
Yeah. But when they first invented, say, penicillin, which was the big in, is that a pharmaceutical?
Yes, it was. Yeah. Yeah. So the medicines that are sold without prescriptions, which is a relatively small number, are just those that are deemed very safe, and therefore you don't need. A doctor to approve that this patient is suitable for it, but they are still pharmaceuticals. And some, it is possible for a medicine to be a prescription medicine, and then for the regulators to decide that they are now happy for that to be sold over the counter. That often it's been out long enough; they consider it
right enough. And then it crosses into. Okay, so let us get to the nub of this, because I'm sure many of the people here have got prescriptions and are taking medicines for this, that, and the other. But you tell us that the pharmaceutical industry is broken.
Yes. So my sort of hypothesis, really, or my conclusion, is that the business model that developed for the modern pharmaceutical industry, which was a model where you get a period of patent, which is a sort of exclusive license, where if you invent a medicine, you're the only company that's allowed to sell it for a certain period, and then at the end of that period, anyone can come in and make it. And so we have a medicine that will be relatively expensive for a short signed period to allow a company that's invested to recoup the money it's spent researching that drug and all the other drugs that maybe haven't worked out. And then this drug will be very cheaply available. And so it will be very widely available around the world. And that model is not really working anymore because of the way in which it's been twisted and abused by the industry in looking to extend that period of exclusivity, in finding ways to ensure that even after that exclusivity has ended, medicines aren't cheap and aren't widely available. And it's also being hamstrung for a number of years by how difficult and how expensive it was becoming on the industry side to invent genuinely new drugs. And so that changed the sorts of drugs that they were researching and with it, the sorts of prices that people were being expected to pay. And so I think you now have a situation where even in very rich countries, including the UK, you have medicines that are too expensive to be of benefit to the patients that would benefit from them. And you also have a really big problem with the types of research that we're seeing and the types of research we're not seeing because of how it's been skewed by these financial incentives.
Okay, the one example that I got here that sort of is that there was an HIV AIDS drug that was going for $17.50, and then overnight you say it went up to $750. How could that possibly happen?
It's outrageous, isn't it? It's a phenomenon that we've seen in the UK as well. So it's by no means a sort of exclusively American phenomenon. It's essentially a group of fairly opportunistic entrepreneurs, often with a financial background rather than a background in science, who saw an opportunity when a medicine is maybe quite old and only one company is making it anymore because it's so cheaply available, to buy the rights to that drug. And then under the systems that operate in both the UK and the US, it is up to companies to set their prices for medicines, for these sorts of medicines when they're off patent. And competition is relied upon to keep the prices cheap. So if you can create a situation where you have a monopoly, you are free, you know, to the extent to which your own sort of ethics and morals will allow it, to set whatever price you wish. And so that was a guy called Martin Shkreli, who's now gone to jail on unrelated securities fraud charges, who saw an opportunity and, you know, reveled in it, gave interviews saying he wished he'd put the price higher, and, you know, this was capitalism in action, and he had no regrets about what he'd done.
But what happens here? I mean, let's say, hypothetically speaking, that this was an NHS drug that they had budgeted for at $17.50, and he or a company comes along and suddenly puts it up to $750. Does the NHS absorb that? Do they stop using it? What happens?
Both of those things with different drugs. So basically the way I sort of became interested in the pharmaceutical industry was discovering in 2016 a group of companies who had essentially made a sort of business model out of identifying old drugs that not many people were making, often only one company, acquiring a license to that drug and then increasing the price, often by thousands of percent. And what was happening with there was the NHS was just paying the extra money for most of those drugs, and it was costing at its peak nearly £400 million a year extra for prescriptions for 70-odd drugs that, you know, dated back 50 or 60 years. There was no new investment in research and development. It was purely profiteering. And in at least one case, I think, which is actually mentioned in the chat here, liothyronine, which is a treatment for people with thyroid problems, a lot of GPs around the country were instructed to take patients off that drug because the local trust had noticed how expensive it had become.
Okay, let me just read that. There's Kathleen Bell saying, I think Billy is aware of the problem with T3 or liothyronine being refused to patients who need it because there was a 6,000% hike in the price in 2006. Was that a British company or...?
That was a British company. So that's one of the stories I tell in the book is about that drug and about that company. This was a company that was involved in a number of drugs that was created by a private equity house in London who had seen the potential for increasing prices across a number of drugs and therefore increasing the value of the company. And that particular drug rose from about, I think it was 16p a tablet to nearly £10 a tablet at its peak. So it's just a huge increase and a huge cost to the NHS in the process.
And then the NHS stopped us. So when we hear stories in the press about so-and-so can't get a drug for such and such a thing because NICE, I think it's called, has refused it doing... It's not because the NHS is being mean. It's because the NHS is being hit by... and capital investment person that wants to just make money. Is that right?
So I think it's probably useful just to sort of separate in our minds the two types of drugs, those that are on patent, which are new medicines that have been relatively recently invented or discovered, and generic medicines, which are these older medicines. So it's the older medicines where we're seeing these big price hikes. They don't have anything to do with NICE. The only market regulation with unbranded generics is competition. which is why these price rises were possible and why the NHS, sort of asleep at the wheel, really didn't do anything about them.
Right.
What we see with NICE is what happens with new medicines, which is where in the UK you say this is what our price is going to be, and this body evaluates whether they consider that to be cost effective. And if it's too expensive or not very good, they will deem it not cost effective and it won't be covered in the UK.
Yeah, and that's so that, you know, they might not be able to help this person with some dreadful disease, but they can, you know, help X number of people in a hospital with the same one. An anonymous in here, and the sun is in my eyes, I have a friend abroad who has to pay €50 for 1 month's supply of apixabin. How much would a box cost if it cost the company to make it? Would you have a rough idea of that, even if not?
I don't know. I have not come across the name of that drug before, but generally speaking, if they're older medicines, simple sort of chemical compounds are made very, very cheaply. I mean, at most a pound or so a packet to manufacture and package. There are expenses to keep it on the market, but the manufacturing side of things with what you would traditionally think of as sort of tablets or pills are very cheap. Now, there are other categories of jobs of drugs that are expensive to make, but I won't complicate things too
much. So there's €50 for a drug that maybe costs €1 or €2 or €5 or something. So the markup is incredible.
Yeah, we can see with lyofurinin, for example, that was a few pounds a packet and then raised to £250 a packet. That's still available and throughout this time was available in many European countries for a few euros, or €2 or €3 a packet. So that gives you a sense of the actual manufacturing costs as opposed to the profits and the sales price being set.
Jean Joyce, I don't know if you know this scandal, my late husband was prescribed OxyContin for pain relief over a long period. Now I've been reading about scandals surrounding this drug. Is that included in your book, Billy?
There is a bit on opioids. There are also a number of other excellent books published in the last few years on that scandal, which has been particularly pronounced in the US, although it's affected a lot of people here in the UK as well. That's a real horrifying scandal of mis-selling, of companies knowing how addictive these pills were, but pushing them anyway. There's allegations of doctors being bribed to push prescriptions. It really is, that is the sort of industry at its worst. It's a symptom of the changes in the industry, which this book traces, where financial metrics just became the all-important and all-encompassing driver of what companies are doing. And so marketing and increasing sales for existing drugs and increasing prices are all crucial parts of getting to these $1 billion a year or $5 billion a year targets that these companies have.
I just want to go back in history for a bit, but is this OxyContin, that type of scandal, is that the opioid scandal?
That's the opioid
scandal, is it? And that's getting us all addicted to opium-based painkillers or antidepressants, and so we become a population of drug addicts, essentially, is it?
So, and it's worse. Yeah, exactly. It was massively over-prescribing these drugs, so encouraging doctors to prescribe them for very relatively mild symptoms and downplaying how addictive they were. So people then became addicted, and lots of people have died from overdoses and all sorts of other issues from those addictions.
And our anonymous again comes back. I think that the drug that was being talked about for Eliquis apixaban to thin the blood. Does that ring a bell with you? But blood thinners and...
It doesn't, I'm afraid. But generally, if it's a chemical compound, especially one that's been made for a number of decades, they're generally very cheap to manufacture.
Yeah. I just want to go, when I say go back in history, with if we have year zero, say, as the invention of penicillin, when was that? That was the 19th century, was it?
Well, it depends what you define as the invention. I mean, it was discovered in the late 20s by Alexander Fleming, but it wasn't turned into the sort of industrial process for being able to ferment it and therefore manufacture it at great scale was during the Second World War. There was a kind of great race to get that ready for.
So it became a mass marketed drug before we had the National Health Service, which meant that people that needed it would have to pay for it somehow. What would you describe as the sort of culture, the psychology, the moral compass of the industry then compared to what it is now?
So I think penicillin, which isn't quite the birth of the pharmaceutical industry, but I think can reasonably be described as the sort of birth of the modern industry, where you start to see the big companies that we still know today really growing in scale and stature. And penicillin was a really sort of collaborative exercise between government and industry and between rival companies. What happened was the researchers in Britain who had been working in Oxford to try and create this at some sort of scale with a sort of makeshift factory, milk pans and all sorts of things, bathtubs, went across to the United States in the middle of the war to the Department of Agriculture to ask for help. And then in turn, the US officials got the support of the several, I think four or five drug companies, and they developed techniques, deep fat fermentation in using different yeasts and all sorts of things to produce this at scale. And these companies worked together and shared expertise. And it was then available very cheaply and very widely, very quickly after the war. It was available to civilians.
And so when then, because that doesn't happen now, I mean, in the culture that you discuss is not, and let's separate off, because I want to get out back to the AstraZeneca and COVID thing in a moment. But generally speaking, that doesn't happen in the industry now. It's all about money, is it?
Yes. So at that point, there was a real sense of public duty and public service. I mean, they were literally in the middle of a world war. But even then, there were different attitudes to science and to commerce. There was a great aversion for many years to scientists working with pharmaceutical companies. It was thought unbecoming. At that point in the Second World War, you couldn't get a patent on a naturally occurring substance, so you couldn't patent the drug itself anyway. The British authorities decided not to seek patents on the manufacturing process. The Americans did, and that gave American companies a head start after the war. And that gradually led to a realization that from companies and from the British government that they'd missed an opportunity. And so the law was changed in Britain. You could then patent drugs. And gradually by the mid-50s, it was becoming more normal for a company to do that and to not share licenses with other companies and receive royalties, which were relatively low and kept the drug cheap, but to just make it exclusively yourself and set a much higher price. And so that's the sort of changes that began to happen. And then if we jump forward to the 1980s, which I think was the really critical decade, companies that began to, there were a few examples, or I'm wary of overcomplicating this, but there were a few examples of particular drugs that were priced very highly, either because they initially had a very small number of patients who would benefit, or because they were at that point very complicated and expensive to manufacture. And those drugs didn't get the pushback in all but one case that other companies had expected. And so gradually, these sort of pricing consultants who sprung up were able to persuade the large drug companies that they were significantly underpricing their products and that there was no merit in being cheap. There was only merit in pushing prices as high as you could while you have exclusivity.
But on the other side of the coin, from that, we had on the show yesterday Rory Kaplan-Jones, who's written a book Always On about smartphones, but he's also got Parkinson's. And I told him that we were going to be talking to you, and he said that he was a fan of Big Pharma because, of course, they're looking into the drugs that can help him. So there is a balance, isn't there, that we have to... chasing the dollar could also chase great inventions?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's completely a balance, and this book is not an argument for the abolition of the pharmaceutical industry or internationalization or anything like that. I mean, governments can't take on the level of risk and investment that occurs into drug development in the industry. But what the book is really calling for is a rebalancing and a return to the sort of the business model and the equilibrium that we had before things were so skewed by purely financial incentives. And the problem is, for some patients in some areas where their drugs are very expensive and it's quite lucrative, there will be lots of research money. But in other areas, there won't be any at all because it's not valuable enough. And so,
should that have a sort of government control on it? Should there be a parameters in which they must operate?
Well, there are lots of different arguments about what the best way of changing research incentives are. I mean, I think we can just start with removing the abuses and to patent terms the marketing abuses, the abuses to the price of old medicines, and that will in itself free up a lot of healthcare resources, which can then be available for these other areas. And if you put back against this particular skewing at the moment with cancer medicines, because of the way in which prices are regulated in the US, which means there is an incentive in lots of parts of the system, including in hospitals, to use the more expensive medicines because of the way in which they're reimbursed. If you remove the problems like that, you rebalance prices across the whole sector, and then these other areas that currently aren't looking very attractive will look much more attractive because the prices won't be outliers elsewhere.
I see. So it's sort of balance. I mean,
it's all about a balance.
Yeah, and the chasing of the money has got to be pulled back a bit to balance. I mean, there's a case I want you to tell us about here. A children's cancer drug was left intentionally. This is a children's cancer drug, right? Left intentionally to expire in Spain because it was more cost effective to have it go out of production. I mean.
So what was going on there is a South African company bought up the rights to a number of cancer treatments from, I think it was, those were from GSK, GlaxoSmithKline,
okay.
And decided they weren't very happy with the price these medicines had been sold at for many years. And so they wanted much higher prices, and they went around various European countries to try and achieve that. And in Spain, the authorities said, no, we're not going to agree to these higher prices. So they said, fine, we're going to let these drugs expire in a warehouse instead. Rather than continue to sell them at what was a perfectly profitable price for GSK.
Or give them to the developing world or something to use. And I know a lot of them don't talk to you, but you've met the industry, obviously. What is the psychology of these, you know, millionaire executives that make these decisions? Are they different to us?
Well, I think one of the big problems is how short-term their priorities have had to become in terms of meeting quarterly targets and pleasing shareholders and ensuring that the number on the stock markets, that the company's valuation continues going up. And so we've seen examples of prices being pushed up purely to meet targets because otherwise, you know, the results in that quarter won't be larger than the results in the previous quarter. And we've seen the influence in drug development where they're interested in safer options, in tweaking an existing drug just enough so you can get a new patent and argue it's presented as a new medicine, rather than necessarily undertaking the riskier work, which maybe there's a higher clinical need, but you've got much more chance of failure. It's going to be expensive to do that, and it might be a long way from any rewards. So I think it's not necessarily that these... It's not that everyone running a drug company is an evil person. The drug companies do a lot of good, but they are set up, they are incentivized to work in this way, and often their compensation is linked to these factors as well. So they have a personal interest beyond the stewardship of the company.
And they see it in different terms to them. If we make a profit, we can research new drugs, whereas they don't see it as costing lives or causing suffering and that sort of thing.
No, the argument is always that these higher prices mean more money for research and development, and therefore we can spend more on drugs in the future, which is only partially true. I mean, lots of companies, lots of examples we've discussed, none of that money was going towards researching new drugs. A lot of it ends up getting given back to shareholders in dividends or share buybacks.
Yeah.
But also, if the cost of developing new drugs is that the drugs become so expensive people can't access them, then what's the point in having these new medicines? I mean, there is much more good that can be done with diverting those funds to access to existing drugs.
Yeah, we've got a few interesting observations, questions here. Pauline Rossi, I know the pediatrician in Italy who spends a rather large proportion of a year on freebies to conferences financed by drug companies in various parts of the world, essentially bribes, ?
Yeah, well, it's there's a huge industry in of sales reps and the sort of world of pitching to doctors, particularly in the US. I had a fascinating interview with a former drug rep from one of the large companies, which quote from at length in the book, talking about how they would approach going to a doctor's surgery and how they would try and weaponize every little bit of information they could get, and the ways in which they create a feeling that they're owed something in return. So even small gestures like bringing bagels for the staff or free pens statistically have been shown to lead to an increase in prescriptions for that medicine. There have been some tightening of the rules around that. In the UK, we now have a transparency register, which you can look up how much doctors have received from different drug companies for things like travel expenses to go to conferences, which are invariably held in the Caribbean in some...
What about we were discussing, I think, earlier about statins, this thing that's meant to stop heart attacks, which seems to have been, promoted and everybody gets prescribed it. Is that something that have been pushed by the drug companies, or would that be medical research, a bit of both? And is it likely to run out of steam?
No, certainly very much being pushed by the drug companies. I mean, one of the other sort of related areas that is very problematic is the influence of these companies on what is termed medical education and in funding trials and studies that are set up with parameters designed to show a benefit for their treatment over a rival, even if that benefit is tiny or in its sort of real world terms, non-existent. Statins were an absolute case study for the industry in how important marketing was. The most successful in commercial terms was not the first statin, and it was not the cheapest statin. It was the statin that was most successfully marketed as Lipitor. And drug reps played a huge role in that. In the US, you have advertising. I don't know if you ever watched American television, but the number of adverts for pharmaceuticals and
I was about to say that.
If you can get this is absolutely extraordinary coming from a country where that's prohibited. But that plays a huge role in pushing in these drugs, ensuring many more people take them, and then obviously and as a result lining them.
I mean, in those American ads, you get one or two lines of beautiful people that are very healthy, and then it says they've got something. Then the rest of the advertisement is about, this could cause you to kill yourself, it could cause you to fail.
Very long and very rapidly spoken disclaimer. Yeah, exactly.
All the disclaimer. Emma says, having lost both my parents to cancer, I've been actively fundraising with cancer research for years, but still no definite news of a cancer cure prevention. Why is it taking so long to conquer cancer, yet there are recognizable progress towards COVID-19? A good question, although there are many different types of cancers, but give us...
That's a very good question. And it touches on an important topic, which is the sort of other half of this equation. And you were asking about the motivations of companies and their executives. One of the big problems the industry had, and it looks to have now passed, but it lasted for 10 or 15 years, was a really dramatic fall in how productive research and development was. It was getting much, much harder to discover new drugs, much more expensive and time-consuming to do so. And that's why companies looked for these other levers, whether it be pricing or marketing, to make up the difference. There are different theories about why that was. It's undoubtedly true that the areas that are left that don't have good medicines for, or we don't have in the case of cancer, cures or preventative treatments for are undoubtedly harder scientifically. The drugs, the areas where we've got lots of good drugs, we had good models for, and they're now often much less development there because it doesn't need to be. So Parkinson's and Alzheimer's is another area that has proved very difficult. One of the unique issues in cancer is that in the US, you can make a lot of money from a cancer treatment, even if its benefit is very minor. And so there's an incentive there for fairly incremental improvements. And I know that there is concern from some scientists that's not encouraging sort of more ambitious and ultimately potentially more successful efforts. It's much safer to go for these incremental improvements, often using proven targets. But we're seeing a lot of movement. I mean, there's a huge amount of money in cancer research. We've seen President Biden this week, I think the UK has followed suit and talked again about this sort of cancer moonshot, which is going to be really important because the other half of this equation is the extent to which government funds already play a huge role in scientific research.
But Emma's point, just to sort of give a top line to it, is that with COVID, we've got, seven different vaccines now, in the space of 2 years, that are more or less not curing it, but preventing it. Whereas with cancer, I as you were talking, Billy, I was trying to think: has anybody said yes? We've got rid of breast cancer. We've got rid of this. Any type of cancer, and we haven't seen that. And there was a similar, wasn't there, sort of big push on HIV/AIDS, and suddenly everybody was. I mean, back, everybody was dying from it if you had it, and now it's just something that's manageable. Put your book up before you answer that, Billy, because I'm going to get the sun out of my eyes. Just excuse me for a second.
Got the sun off the book as well now. Well, just to start answering that, the truth is they're very different diseases. I mean, they now think the more they learn about cancer that it's not one disease; it's quite a large number of diseases. And what we used to think of as particular types of cancer, like breast cancer or lung cancer, are now able to be subdivided into much smaller categories. We have seen, having said that, these drugs with only incremental improvements can get become quite lucrative revenue streams. We have recently seen some quite exciting advances from understanding in cancer. I mean, immunotherapies are opening up a sort of new way of potentially tackling this disease. But you just can't make a kind of comparison between cancer and it's hugely complicated and hugely different forms and COVID, which was a new retrovirus. We knew quite a lot about retroviruses. We know quite a lot about vaccines. There was a stroke of very good fortune in that this new technology, mRNA technology, proved to work with this. That's the first time we've had an mRNA vaccine, and that the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines are both of that type. But vaccines are generally much quicker to develop than completely new drugs.
Yeah, and a point from Angie here is the profitability of cancer palliatives and treatments impeding the development of a cure or prevention.
I think to a degree, there certainly is a concern among scientists about that. But you'd be remiss to, I mean, there's still a huge amount of money. Cancer gets so much funding money that no one is sitting on a model that they think is likely to be very successful and it can't get the funding. What you do have in cancer is that some types of cancer get much more funding than others. And those tend to be the cancers that are more common in the sort of rich West. So even within that, but no, I mean, I think the treatment of cancer is a very difficult problem. They're making progress, and there's a huge amount of resources there, but it's not sort of, yeah, it's very challenging.
And one question from Amber, and after that, I want to get us onto healthy aging, we call it, what the industry is doing now. But a biologic for rheumatoid arthritis costs $10,000 a year, which have been changed to cheaper biosimilars, but may not work as well as biologics, and they all have side effects. This is the generic drugs. Is it coming?
Yeah. So this is another big issue that's going to that's sort of playing out at the moment with drugs. Traditionally, were chemical compounds, and so a generic version was the same drug with the same profile. The tests required to ensure that it's released in the body in the same way are relatively straightforward. And that's why you have lots of different versions of a drug once it goes off patent that all act in the same way in patients. It's quite easy to create a generic version. These new biological medicines, which are now starting to come off patent and therefore be open to be genericized, are much more complicated to make and much more difficult. You can't create a perfect copy in the same way because of biological material. It's not just a chemical compound. And so biosimilars, which is the sort of name for generic biological medicines, are more expensive than chemical generics. They don't have the same discounts. And as she points out, they can have slightly different profiles in how they're used by patients. But I think that is improved. It's an area that's improving. Healthcare systems are very incentivized to encourage biosimilars because of the savings involved and to ensure that they work effectively. So I think that it's an issue, but it's one that's definitely improving and sort of being solved, certainly in some areas.
I was going to ask you another question about that, but we're running out of time, and I want to get on to the demographic of, say, the 55 plus demographic or 60, whatever you want to call it. Well, you have a number of things going on, don't you? You have, the body's, a bit of arthritis, a bit of this, and then, you're retiring, your mind might not be quite, active in that. And the whole Goldster ethos is to keep people active, keep them thinking, keep them stimulated, so that you can age healthily without resorting as little as possible to pharmaceuticals. What is the industry's view of that? Are they Are they dealing with that in a mature way? Is it all about money? Is there money in the aging?
In terms of the preventative approach as opposed to just treating illness itself, I think one of the problems with the current model is that the way in which intellectual property laws work, it's very easy to commercialize a drug, whether that be a biologic or a chemical compound. It's much more difficult to protect and therefore commercialize preventative measures, which, you know, whether that be types of therapy or exercise or whatever it is. So that is a tricky area for the industry, and as a result, we see such a focus on pharmaceuticals. One area that is changing is this sort of move towards wearable technology that monitors your health and what that can do in terms of flagging any potential issues up at a much earlier stage. I think we could easily see a move in which the NHS is persuaded to pay for things like that for patients once they reach a certain age, because it will the savings will come. There are so many savings for a healthcare system if you can prevent illness as opposed to treat it, particularly if it requires hospitalisation.
Yeah. And if say somebody walks into a GP's office and they've got a bit of a pain on their hip, or they're feeling a little blue, and the GP there has been approached by a drug company for a drug against depression or a drug against arthritis, where they could do physiotherapy or go to a Goldster class or go to a social event or something. What is the GP going to do in today's environment? Take the party, the free site, the drug company?
GPs take, like all doctors, have taken an oath and will do what they believe to be in the best interest of patients. But the statistics don't lie. If they've been visited by a sales rep and given a load of information about why this treatment is better than the alternatives that you outline there, then they are statistically more likely to prescribe a pill. And I think it requires a bit of a change of mindset from patients as well, because you go to a doctor, you're given a pill, you're happy, here's a concrete thing that hopefully is going to make you better. We have this, the NHS is moving towards what it calls social prescribing to try and encourage people to exercise or give up smoking or whatever it is. But you need people to go along with it. You need adherence, otherwise you don't get the benefits from that.
Yes, I was going to say, are they doing it enough? Are they saying, well, you need to go for a run, you need to go for a walk, you need to have a conversation, have some mental stimulation, or,
It's certainly a direction of travel that they're going in. I think there's more funding for the next few years to increase the number of what they call social prescribers, which is specifically advising on those sorts of approaches. But clearly there's a lot more that could be done there. Financially, there are huge savings to be made. It's again the short term, long term thing that requires a bit of ambition to say we'll spend a bit more this year, but we know we'll get these huge savings in the long run from prevention.
Yeah, Angie says, oh goodness, I've got a few things coming in. Analogous to dentistry, this is about the cancer that's just disappeared from my screen because they're coming in so quickly. Let's cover them before we... analogous to dentistry, surely by now a coating to prevent decay could be developed and applied prophylactically, but no, that would put the dentists out of business. I think we're talking about cancer treatment there. Any ring a bell with you at all, or...?
I certainly don't think that they're sitting on a cure and don't want to do anything with it, because... it would put all the other drugs out of business. But companies have struggled to persuade shareholders that treatments that are cures in other areas are a good investment. Gilead is an American company, developed a cure for hepatitis C. It was extremely expensive. It was rationed in the UK and many other countries because of the price, and brought in billions and billions. But despite that, within a few years, their share price took a huge hit because they were curing people, and so there was no long-term revenue stream.
Oh, right. You cure people and you kind of look like a cure for smallpox. I guess there's no revenue in making a smallpox.
It's why vaccines were not seen as an attractive area until COVID hit, because they were relatively cheap, and you take, you're vaccinated and then you're vaccinated. You're not going to be coming back every summer unless it's for the flu vaccine.
Yeah. Emma's back. You've disheartened Emma about billions poured in cancer research and no cure. So I'm going to ask you in a few minutes, your book reads like a thriller, like The Big Short or something. So I'm going to ask you to give us the ending and give us a spoiler. But Liz says, anonymous. Oh, Liz, I'm sorry. I won't say anything on that question unless you want me to, doesn't matter. Thank you, Liz. GPs are much more inclined to issue medication rather than discuss alternatives, such as homeopathy, nutrition, exercise, etc., in my experience. We've discussed that, and that rings a bell with you, doesn't it, Billy Suri? There is a great order in nature when people indulge in too many toxic chemicals and drugs and don't get enough healthy aging. She mentions Goldster approach. They are overlooking natural law and won't feel well, I think. That's what we've been discussing. Is that your view, Billy? Now, you're an expert. If you woke up feeling a little depressed one day and went to see your GP, what would you expect them to say to a young man like you?
I think as patients, we have responsibilities as well, and GPs are happy to discuss options if you discuss things with them. I think it's worth bearing in mind all of these context and looking at transparency data as usual GP been speaking to recently, but I don't think it's, I wouldn't go as far as that or anything.
Yeah. And Angie says, this is slightly out of the pharmaceutical range, but healthy aging, as we're all living longer and hopefully more healthily, what is disappointing now is NHS screening is not keeping pace with this. Screening for certain female cancers still stops when you hit 65. Any of that your expertise, Billy?
No, not really. I mean, obviously, the NHS budgets have been very strained for many years now, and they've got this huge backlog of cases, the treatments to be dealing with from COVID interrupting services. So, this is one of the reasons why pharmaceuticals is such an important area for everyone, is because the money that is being spent on those price increases or drugs that are overpriced is money that could have been diverted to other parts of the health sector, whether that be more nurses or more screening or whatever it is.
Yeah. And Liz, back to us, my GPs tend to say there is no evidence or little evidence for alternative approaches. I have also heard that too from my GP, I must say. When actually once they said that I was exercising too much when I said I'd been cycling to Paris and back. So, before we go on to what's coming up next, and then I want you to stick around for that, sick money, pharmaceutical industry broken, don't leave us on a downbeat note. How do you end it, Billy?
So, in its simplest version, several of the sort of villains of the piece do get some form of comeuppance, as readers will see. At the end of the book, I think there's also quite a bit of a section in which I sort of explore how we can fix some of these problems and how some things are improving already. And I don't think it's as bleak an outlook as it perhaps can sound when we, depending on which bits we focus on. There are some great medical advances going on. There are some very innovative approaches to driving prices down and ensuring those advances are accessible to everyone. We've seen some of those, the fruits of that recently. And so there's a lot to be done. There's a lot that's needs changing, but it's not all it's sort of doom and gloom. And
the AstraZeneca thing, of course, they were giving that a cost, weren't they? So there was some sort of, uplifting thought there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was a real throwback to an era. I mean, back in the day, drug companies would sometimes develop diseases. There was a famous case with a company called Merck and a treatment for river blindness where they just decided to give the drug away for free to those who would benefit. And yet absolutely AstraZeneca in electing to sell it on a not-for-profit basis, albeit for a period they're now increasing the prices, was a great sort of public service.
Okay, now stay there. Don't run away. I've got to tell people what's coming up and then I want to come back to you for a final pressing question. February the 8th, that's next Tuesday, our sister show, Purpose, Passion and Grit, I'm with Terry Collingsworth, an American human rights lawyer who fights slavery in our supply chains, particularly child slavery in the chocolate industry in Africa and takes on some of the biggest companies in the world. Find out what happened when he met Nestle in the US Supreme Court. Then February the 10th, I think that's next Thursday, Inside Story, a book called Somewhere to Live by Jeff Payne, who spent a career designing towns in far-flung places, including as a young urban planner. He helped map out Saddam Hussein's Baghdad. In his spare time, he flies gliders, sometimes landing in fields of sheep and champagne parties on country estates, and we're celebrating Jeff's just turned 80th birthday. And then next Friday, a week from today, Lucinda is freshly back from the Dubai Literary Festival, where she is at the moment. We're not lying by the pool. She's scouring for goals to guests. She's with Sophie Hannah, The Killings and Kingfisher Hall, and a Hercule Poirot story. Yes, that's Agatha Christie. Sophie is signed with the Christie Estate. What's it like to follow in the greatest cozy crime writer's footsteps? And in the next 3 minutes we've got left, Billy, slavery, that's an investigation, isn't it? Have you ever done any of that sort of stuff?
I've done a little bit on some of the chocolate trade and links to slavery, but nothing very in-depth. It would be a great one to be able to get out and go to parts of the world where this is going on and really sort of see what's happening firsthand.
Yes, I mean, with all the statues being pulled down about historic slavery, and there's still all this stuff going on that we don't know much about. I covered that 20 years ago, 10 years ago, and nothing seems to change much. But your final question to you is, if you had an unlimited budget and the full support of your editors, not pharmaceuticals, what investigation would you like to do?
It's a good question. It's a very difficult one to answer, to be honest. There isn't sort of one big topic that I haven't been able to kind of get involved with that I would like to. I mean, I think the best investigations are about about power and sort of misuse of power. So some sort of great global political scandal that you need to jump around the world to uncover would be fantastic. But
right, what about the Conservative Party, which you've got track record with?
Yeah, I think the problem at the moment is if you started an investigation now, you wouldn't necessarily be confident that the same people are going to be in power when it was ready to run. But
we would have forgotten that. Okay, so that's it. That's the great Billy Kenver and his world of investigative journalism. This is his book. Hold it up, Billy, because yours comes out better than mine. This is Sick Money, the Inside the Pharmaceutical Industry. Follow him on Twitter. I put it there somewhere in the chat. Email him, buy his book if you want to know how our medicines get to us and what they're inventing. Have we got a last one before we go? Yes, let's say, on a broader note, Angie, what's your gut feeling about safety of the NHS, our national treasure, from the threat of surrender of pharma to privatization? Give us a 5-second answer on that.
I'm optimistic, but you know, caution is required.
Okay. And Kathleen, the Competition and Marketing Authority, lithothyronine makers $100 million. That was that big case that we were talking about before. Yes. Brilliant. Thank you for all of those questions and contributions. Pauline Rossi, really enjoyed the session. Somebody with a number, 921. Great discussion. Thank you, Billy. It's been great to see you all. Until next week, thank you for our team at Golster supporting all this, the questions and the comments. Until next week, goodbye, everyone. See you soon. Stay involved, stay active, and above all, stay safe. Bye. Thanks, Billy.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you for listening, and find out our vast range on www.golster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Golster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Golster.